This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the digital revolution, and with me to talk about this issue is Professor S. Craig Watkins. He teaches at University of Texas down in Austin, and he's the author of several books, including Hip Hop Matters, Politics, Pop Culture, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Movement, and Representing Hip Hop Culture and the Production of Black Cinema. But most recently, the book is The Young and the Digital. Craig Watkins, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In The Young and the Digital, you argue that TV is on its way out as the predominant entertainment focus of our society. Why has that happened?
You know, it's happening for at least a couple of reasons. For much of the middle to latter part of the 20th century, TV was literally, right, the dominant media, the dominant technology, the dominant screen in our lives. I mean, it was the first screen that we turned on. It was the first screen that we relied on for news and information, for entertainment. And when you talk to young people today, that 50-year sort of tradition, those customs are suddenly changing, right, and being sort of reversed. And in many respects, I think it has to do with the fact that, young people, like most of us increasingly, are drawn to screens and drawn to technologies that are more interactive, drawn to screens and technologies that are more social, that are more communal. But more importantly, right, it's just this idea of being able to sort of interact with technology or media and use media kind of on our own schedule, this idea of media that's anytime, anywhere. And sort of the traditional broadcast model of appointment television is just really kind of waning. And you see that in terms of just a steady declining numbers of primetime viewers in this country. It also sort of suggests that more interactive kinds of entertainment like video games are becoming more popular amongst young people. And this idea that young people like the idea of being more engaged, being more sort of involved and participating in the media. And television in some ways represents, I think, a very different kind of experience, a very different kind of cultural
kind of a one-way experience. And exactly. You criticize the TV industry for basically being complacent and for putting out a deficient product ultimately at the end, or a product that isn't as useful to users as the computer is.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think the industry is just now beginning to acknowledge that it has been slow to respond to the digital revolution. It's only been within the last 3 to 4 years or so that the industry has begun to make its content available online, making its content available via mobile devices like first the iPod and more recently mobile phones. And it's a recognition that the world is changing, right? And how we consume media, how we use media is rapidly changing. And those more sort of established models and traditions of behavior are simply no longer in play. As I was doing this research, I was really struck by the kinds of parallels that you see happening in television compared to what happened with the music industry. And we saw what happened with the music industry, an industry that was slow to respond to the digital revolution, slow to respond to downloads, slow to respond to media on the go. And as a result, the music industry has suffered immense losses in terms of CD sales. But more importantly, it's really just become kind of out of step with the cultural times.
Is this transition, what are the pluses and minuses of this transition?
The pluses are, I think that it gives us, consumers and users, perhaps a little bit, actually a lot more control of our own media environment. In fact, there's this notion that increasingly our media world is becoming more personalized, more customized, and we're really able to sort of create and fashion our own kind of personal media experience. And I think that's something that has given us more control over the content that we consume, the content that we share with our friends, with our acquaintances. And in that way, because if you think about the older models, right, it was this sort of one-way, one-to-many kind of broadcasting model. And now I think what the TV industry, like the film industry, like the music industry is having to sort of grapple with is this idea that they no longer dictate or control how we consume the content that even they produce and distribute. And I think that's sort of given them cause for pause and trying to rethink their own models. You know, one of the consequences is, you know, because we live in an environment where we can access, you know, TV programs, where we can access movie clips, where we can access quick video games and this sort anytime, anywhere, no matter where we are. You know, there is this issue of, you know, to what extent is too much content too easily available? Is that always a good thing? And for example, in my own personal experience as a university professor, students in classrooms with their laptops, let's say, for example, using those laptops to catch up with YouTube video clips, using their laptops to catch up with their friends on Facebook, you know, talking to high school teachers, they complain about students with their iPods in the classroom.
I mean, doesn't that drive you crazy as a teacher?
Yeah.
I mean, so, I remember back in the day, someone was reading a newspaper in a lecture hall and they'd get chewed out by the professor.
So think about now, you know, sitting in a classroom. One of the things that I did when I was writing this book is I would go and sit in large lecture classrooms, not necessarily classes that I was teaching, but that maybe my colleagues or maybe graduate assistant teachers were teaching. And I would just sit in the back and just kind of observe kind of what students would be doing in those classrooms because they're large. We're talking 200, 250 plus students. And at least a third of them, right, if not more, were oftentimes with their laptops near the back of the classroom, sometimes listening to lecture, but oftentimes, you know, watching video clips, oftentimes catching up on Facebook. And so there is this idea of because media is so mobile, because media now is with us no matter where we are, I liken it to fast food. I call it fast entertainment, right? It's cheap, it's easy to get, it's quick. But to what degree, you know, is that kind of constant access to media and constant access to our friends always a good thing?
Back to the teacher just for a second. In high schools, or at least in my son's high school, they were taking people's iPods away. That's a losing battle in college. It may be a losing battle in high school, but maybe a losing battle in eighth grade.
It's funny because, you know, I was surprised to learn that actually most school districts around the country allow students to bring mobile and entertainment devices into the classroom. For example, their phones, for example, their iPods. Now, there's some rules on when they can use them and where they can use them. But just imagine, right, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you know, the idea that, you know, I could bring my CD player into the classroom, that I, you know, 20 years ago, you could bring your transistor radio into the classroom. You know, it would not have happened, but it suggests in some ways how the culture has shifted and how the culture has changed. Now, one of the reasons that schools permit students to bring these technologies, particularly the phone into the classroom, it was striking to me, is because parents insist that their kids have phones. And so it makes sense because, you know, schedules are busy, families are busy, moving in different directions. So it's a way to kind of micromanage your day, to kind of coordinate with each other. There's one school district, however, the largest school district in the United States, New York City, they don't allow mobile phones into the classroom. There was a huge battle between parents and local city officials about that. But they simply decided that the phones are too much of a distraction. Not only were kids texting each other in classroom, but there was this fear that they were taking pictures of each other in the locker room and passing them on to other friends, taking pictures of exams and passing them on to other students. And so there were all kinds of concerns about the degree to which technology was disrupting what they considered to be a very sort of strong and productive kind of learning environment.
And from the teacher's perspective, you really must, teachers and professors must have to up their game if they're going to want to keep students' attention.
You know, it's funny. I did an interview with the Chronicle of Higher Education a few weeks ago, and it was precisely about some of these issues. And I said that in some respects, you know, the traditional sort of lecture, that I'm increasingly beginning to see that as a kind of outdated way of interacting with students. I liken it in some ways to the broadcast model, right? The sort of one-to-many where we expect students just to sit there like these sort of passive recipients, you know, take notes and to listen to us, you know, share all of this sort of knowledge with them that we have. And while elements of that I think are still necessary, you know, I think students bring a very different kind of instinct. They bring very different kinds of cultural habits and tendencies into the classroom. And so there's just an expectation on their part that they're never disconnected, right, from their friends, that they're never disconnected from the information landscape that exists in our world today. And so it is a constant challenge, right, to keep students engaged, to keep them sort of on attention and focused. I have some colleagues, right, who have decided to disallow laptops in the classroom for those reasons. I haven't gone that far yet, but it can be a challenge, though.
It sounds to me like the next model is a more interactive teaching model. Exactly. Is that what you're driving at?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Much more interactive, in some ways much more conversational, you know, ways. And some people liken that kind of interactive learning environment to what takes place, for example, with our experiences with video games. It's this idea that video games encourage participation, video games encourage trial and error. More importantly, video games encourage a more kind of active kind of engagement as opposed to a more passive, reception of television. And some are suggesting that it's those kinds of instincts, it's those kinds of learning habits and tendencies and inclinations that students are walking into the classroom with. So how do we customize our classroom and formal learning environments to better suit, you know, kids who bring different kinds of cultural experiences and practices into the classroom?
You're listening to Professor S. Craig Watkins, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin, and he's the author of a new and fascinating book called The Young and the Digital. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What was your response to this whole debate, you know, is the internet is making us stupid?
Yeah, it's an interesting debate and a provocative one. In some ways, it's a difficult one for me to agree with, insofar as the internet, we've oftentimes, I mean, from the very beginning of the internet sort of coming into our lives, you know, we've seen it as this rich resource in terms of information, in terms of access to content. And so in that sense, I think it provides, right, just an overwhelming sea of information. The challenge, right, is how do we mine that information? And because there's so much out there, how do we sift through, you know, some of the lesser quality content, if I can say that, to some of the perhaps more informing, richer content that's certainly there? And so I'm less inclined to sort of agree with that notion. I do understand some concerns about the degree to which the internet creates a kind of echo chamber. That is this idea that, people only go online to read articles, to read blogs, to read journalists, or to read commentary that in some ways reinforces their own view of the world. And to what degree does that sort of create these kinds of boundaries and divisions where we never come into contact with people who may think differently than us, that we never come into contact with people who perhaps develop a very different worldview from us. And so elements of that, I think, are important to sort of consider as we begin to think about what, you know, this sort of wealth of information means for us and how we use it.
Well, and how would we break out of those silos?
You know, it's difficult because, you know, it's happening not only in terms of the news and information that we seek. I think it's also happening in terms of the kinds of communities that we build, the kinds of networks that we build. It's one of the things that I sort of ponder in the book is, I mean, we know that social network sites, for example, are growing in popularity, that more and more people are using Facebook, more and more people are using these different kinds of social tools and social platforms. What I'm trying to gain a better understanding of is how are we using these platforms, and more importantly, who are we connecting with via these platforms? And there's some evidence, right, that when we think of the World Wide Web, right, access to anybody anywhere in the world, this sort of global network, this sort of global human network that's just fascinating in a lot of ways. But in many respects, if you think about more common, more typical, more routine uses of social media, we tend to use it to connect with and to communicate with people who are very close to us, right? Close to us in terms of personal relationships, close friends, acquaintances, family, but also in terms of just geographical proximity as well. So in many respects, I think the World Wide Web, we really use it more as a kind of local web. And so that raises questions about the degree to which we are becoming increasingly insular, or the degree to which we are only, again, connecting with and communicating with people who think like sort of like-minded people. And how do we break out of that? You know, I'm not really sure, because what has happened, for better or worse, is that these have become the preferred and typical ways in which we use these technologies. I think it has implications for race. It has implications for class in terms of who we're communicating with, who we're building networks with, and the kinds of divisions offline that manage to also inform and influence the communities that we build online.
Craig Watkins, what are some of those implications for race or for class?
It was interesting, you know, as we were, my graduate students and I, or my graduate student assistant and I, as we were doing some of the research for this book, and we did surveys and we did interviews, and we were particularly interested in college students, and even more specifically white college students, their sort of decisive move towards Facebook and their kind of abandonment of MySpace. When we started doing these interviews and when we started collecting this data about four years ago, many of these students had initial social networking experience with MySpace. when they went on to college, they sort of migrated and moved on to Facebook. And we were sort of struck by that transition from one platform to the next. And what we ended up sort of learning in our one-on-one conversations with them and the surveys that we collected is that in some ways they began to sort of define MySpace as a place that was kind of populated by people that they didn't necessarily want to be associated with, primarily young blacks and Latinos or immigrants, people who weren't affluent, people who weren't college educated, people who weren't on the same kind of life course track that they were on.
And they were pretty explicit about it.
Yeah, exactly. And they saw Facebook, right, as a much more exclusive community, a much more selective community. And I sort of liken their move to Facebook in some ways, drawing some parallels to the rise of gated communities around America. That is sort of living amongst people who are like-minded, living amongst people who share a similar kind of lifestyle. Sort of interesting, Bill Bishop a year or so ago wrote an interesting book called The Big Sort, where he talked about how our communities have become sort of populated and sort of redefined in terms of people living amongst people who think like them, who look like them, who sort of see the world in the same way that they do. And it struck me as a sort of interesting sort of parallel in terms of what's happening in the digital world and this kind of digital sorting that's going. Mm. So the words that people would even use to describe Facebook as clean, as educated, versus MySpace as trashy, as uneducated, there was a sort of racial and class coding of MySpace and Facebook that I thought was quite interesting.
And there also was an analogy with the gated community that you just mentioned, Craig Watkins, and that is Facebook is safe, MySpace isn't safe.
Yeah, yeah. And there was this idea that and the concerns about safety weren't so much, you know, the kinds of concerns that we hear echoed in the mainstream press about, you know, predators and things of that sort. But it was really about what I sort of term not necessarily safety, but security, right? And wanting to share themselves with their friends via pictures, via wall posts, status updates, but share it with people who they trusted, share it with people who they sort of saw, right, as sort of similar to them in some important kinds of ways, you know, college educated, you know, middle class, professional oriented, versus people who were perceived on MySpace to be, you know, not college educated, perhaps coming from a very different socioeconomic background, and using really interesting words to sort of define MySpace and to define Facebook users.
Now, tell me and tell the person listening to this show what the breakdown is. Still, MySpace is. There are more Latinos on MySpace than on Facebook, flat out, or is that about even?
You know, it's that data is sort of beginning to evolve in some ways. You know, not that long ago, you know, MySpace was sort of the big kid on the block, so to speak, in terms of social network sites, both in this country and to some degree around the world. Over the last year and a half or so, MySpace user base has steadily kind of eroded, whereas Facebook has continued to sort of grow and expand both in this country and around the world. Most surveys and most of the research data will tell you that in terms of MySpace, you know, Latinos in particular, young Latinos at least in particular, have tended to prefer MySpace. Young immigrants have usually tended to prefer MySpace. To some degree, similarly with African-American youth. But I think that's beginning to change somewhat insofar as Facebook, you know, it's expanding and more users are kind of coming to the party, if you will, in terms of Facebook.
And then maybe the Facebook is going to win out all over the place.
Yeah, that's certainly what's happening. I mean, MySpace's troubles are numerous. You know, there have been some quality control issues with the platform from the very beginning, right? Even as MySpace was sort of, you know, attracting millions and millions of users, there was always some concerns about, the variety of people on MySpace. This idea, right, that it was a very kind of chaotic kind of community and a chaotic kind of user base. And the owners of MySpace, and even when Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation bought it, have never really figured out MySpace and figured out how to actually make MySpace work for them financially in the ways that they
want. Well, if Rupert Murdoch loses money on it, that would be a great thing.
Yeah. Well, so far that, you know, the buzz is that it hasn't turned out in the ways that he had anticipated. In fact, MySpace, the brand, right, has sort of eroded since he acquired it in 2005.
Craig Watkins, can we talk about some negative consequences of living online? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to start from personal experience with my daughter when she was younger. She's now, well, she's going to be 20. But when she was a young teenager, you know, she was on there all the time. And I remember a friend of hers, a really nice young girl who I coached in soccer at one point along the road, telling her mom, who was criticizing her for being online so much, "Mom, I need to be online. This is my full-time job." And I bet she was on 40. I bet my daughter was on 40 hours a week. Yeah. And you say in your book, The Young and the Digital, that the online world is a way to relieve stress, but it's also a stressor.
Yeah,
especially for these young kids.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's. You're right. It's. I mean, we go to the online world as a way to unwind. I mean, much like how we use television in the past to relax, to unwind, to catch up, to entertain ourselves, to amuse ourselves. But the always on culture that we live in today, that is always connected via our mobile phones, our Blackberries, always connected via our laptops, via Facebook, you know, MySpace, you know, what Twitter, you know, even more so today. That's a full-time job, right? And in some ways, it sort of begins to generate a certain degree of anxiety. This idea, right, that there's always somebody that I should be communicating with. There's always somebody I should be sharing some content with. There's always somebody, right, that I should be interacting with. And no matter where we are, in the classroom, at work, even driving, you know, a lot of sort of conversations in this country and around the world about even when we're driving, right, feeling the need to text, feeling the need to sort of reach out and touch someone via these platforms that we use. And it creates, right, a certain sense of anxiety. It creates what Linda Stone, sort of technology thought leader, refers to as sort of the word that she uses, continuous partial attention. And this idea that we sort of live in a state where our attention is sort of always continually sort of divided, always sort of moving across different screens, different platforms, different networks, and that generates, right, a certain degree of stress, that generates a certain degree of anxiety, because you can never turn it off, right? I mean, asking students to turn, or asking young people just to turn it off, to turn off the mobile phone, to turn off the laptop, is in some ways asking them to turn off their lives, right? For them, they can't imagine, right, to be disconnected, right, to never be able to interact or to communicate. Now, when I was writing this book, did interviews with parents, right, with teenagers, and it talked about, you know, how the household has changed, right, since their teens have gone online, received a computer, received their own mobile phone, and some parents, right, having to sort of take away the mobile phone at late night just so that their students or their children will get some rest.
Because they'll be up till 1 or 2.
Yeah, exactly. Because the technology has enabled young people to sort of create something that generations of young people have always coveted but never necessarily had access to, and that is a space that they can call their own, right? And the technology has allowed them to sort of build those spaces and to build those networks of interaction and communication.
But that space can also be a hothouse for gossip or slander or clickishness
exactly.
And cruelty.
Yeah, yeah. And that issue of cyberbullying, right, has become very important in schools around this country and increasingly around the world. That is, you know, students using the technology or young people using the technology, you know, to spread rumors, all of the things that we did, right, when we were students. And when we were young, but you did them in a way that was much more limited. When you came home from school, maybe you could share some of those rumors and gossips via telephone conversations. But now, with the click of a button, right, you can distribute those rumors. You can distribute that content. You can, you know, distribute uncomplimentary images with the click of a button to an entire student population. And so the stakes at which these issues are sort of emerging, I think, are quite greater, and therefore the consequences are oftentimes greater as well.
I'm speaking with Professor Craig Watkins. He teaches down at UT Austin, and this is Progressive Radio. What about you have a chapter on addiction, internet addiction, game addiction. And for a while there, it looked like you were uncomfortable going all the way and saying, yes, it is an addiction. But by the end of the chapter, it seemed that you were recognizing that there is addictive behavior there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that the question, you know, are we, you know, have we become slaves to the technology that we now use and consume? Is certainly not unique to the internet, and certainly not unique to mobile devices. you know, but it's been one that has been a fairly sort of consistent debate going back to the mid to late 1990s when researchers with some degree of rigor began to start trying to investigate these questions, trying to measure to what degree are we developing addictive-like tendencies to these technologies. And to be honest with you, the debate is still kind of inconclusive. You know, when you talk with, you know, medical experts, there's still a lot of debate within that community about, you know, are we really sort of genuinely addicted to the internet, addicted to video games in the way that someone might be addicted to drugs or addicted to alcohol with this sort of physiological kind of transformation, right? Something biological happening and going on. But as I was doing research for the book, you know, I was fascinated by a lot of the ways in which researchers are beginning, scientists are beginning to understand the ways in which our brains work and operate. And they sort of have identified this region of the brain that they call the sort of reward region, right? That's responsible for how we feel when we're rewarded, gratitude, pleasure, you know, this sort of intense degree of satisfaction that we can experience. And there is some suggestion, right, that games and what they call more natural kinds of addictions can take place. Natural being anything that's not chemical. You know, addictions to food, addictions to games, addictions to, you know, whatever it is that people can become addicted to, sex. And so it's a lot. I think we're still learning. I mean, what I came away with is I'm still not convinced that most of us suffer internet addiction. I mean, I'm online all the time. You know, like most people, I've got my phone with me. I'm constantly in contact and constantly communicating with this or that person. But to what degree that's, you know, I think there's a difference between habitual behavior and addictive behavior. And addictive behavior, I think, is behavior that in some ways begins to undermine the quality of our lives, the quality of our relationships to other people. And you see some negative consequences happening in that way. In some instances, yes, I think that's happening with the current technology. But I think those are extreme cases. I mean, we did come across people, for example, gamers, you know, who spend, you know, 8 to 10, 12 hours a day, right, in a sort of virtual gaming world like World of Warcraft. Those are sort of, again, extreme examples, and those are individuals who certainly are tilting towards what we might call sort of problematic use of the technology.
But there is a draw, though, I mean, even in my work life, to compulsively check the email and or to go online and see, you know, to my favorite website or something.
Yeah.
And so that there is some draw there that is kind of strong and hard to resist, but I wouldn't say it's totally getting in the way. But it is a time suck, though.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
It's a major time suck. And when we talk to students and young people, and we ask them, you know, what concerns you, right, about your use of technology, your engagement with technology, your peers engaging with technology. And one of the things that they consistently refer to is, and that's the word that they use, you know, it's a major time suck. When I'm supposed to be working on a paper, when I'm supposed to be studying for an exam, or when I'm at work, right, and I'm trying to complete a task, I always find myself checking in on Facebook, you know, seeing what status updates, seeing what pictures my friends have posted. I'm always going to YouTube to see what it is that people are talking about, to see the, you know, the funny video clip from Letterman or from Leno or from, you know, Saturday Night Live, whatever the case is. And there is this sort of constant sort of urge, if you will, to always sort of, you know, consume this kind of peripheral entertainment, peripheral content that's out there, that oftentimes does impose and that oftentimes does impact, you know, the ways in which we go about trying to complete tasks. And this is a whole issue of kind of multitasking, right? Mm-hmm. We've got multiple windows open on our screens. We've got multiple platforms and devices sitting right next to us as we're watching TV, as we're working on a computer. I tend to think that distraction is more of an issue than addiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to have to be the last word. We're out of time. Fascinating topic and conversation. Professor Craig Watkins, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.